And why not, pray tell?
My prince, Tychanic said, again touching Faradin's arm.
What is it, Tyke?
We brought him here under bonded agreement with the guild. He is to be returned to Dune. I am summoned back to Arrakis, the preacher said.
Who summons you? Faradin demanded.
A power greater than thine, prince. Faradin shot a questioning glance at Tychanic.
Is he an Atreides spy?
Not likely, my prince. Alia has put a price on his head.
If it's not the Atreides, then who summons you? Faradin asked, returning his attention to the preacher.
A power greater than the Atreides. A chuckle escaped Faradin. This was only mystic nonsense. How could Tyke be fooled by such stuff? This preacher had been summoned, most likely by a dream. Of what importance were dreams?
This has been a waste of time, Tyke, Faradin said. Why did you subject me to this farce?
There is a double price here, my prince, Tychanic said. This interpreter of dreams promised me to deliver Duncan Idaho as an agent of House Carino. All he asked was to meet you and interpret your dream.
And Tychanic added to himself,
or so he told Wencissia.
New doubts assailed the Bashar. Why is my dream so important to you, old man? Faradin asked.
Your dream tells me that great events move toward a logical conclusion, the preacher said. I must hasten my return.
Mocking, Faradin said, and you will remain inscrutable, giving me no advice.
Advice, prince, is a dangerous commodity, but I will venture a few words which you may take as advice, or in any other way which pleases you.
By all means, Faradin said.
The preacher held his masked face, rigidly confronting Faradin.
Governments may rise and fall for reasons which appear insignificant, prince. What small events! An argument between two women, which way the wind blows on a certain day, a sneeze, a cough, the length of a garment, or the chance collision of a fleck of sand in a courtier's eye. It is not always the majestic concerns of imperial ministers which dictate the course of history. Nor is it necessarily the pontifications of priests which move the hands of God.
Faradin found himself profoundly stirred by these words and could not explain his emotion. Tychanic, however, had focused on one phrase. Why did this preacher speak of a garment? Tychanic's mind focused on the imperial costumes dispatched to the Atreides twins, the tigers trained to attack. Was this old man voicing a subtle warning? How much did he know?
How is this advice? Faradin asked.
If you would succeed, the preacher said, you must reduce your strategy to its point of application. Where does one apply strategy? At a particular place, and with a particular people in mind. But even with the greatest concern for minutiae, some small detail with no significance attached to it will escape you. Can your strategy, prince, be reduced to the ambitions of a regional governor's wife?
His voice cold, Tychanic interrupted.
Why do you harp upon strategy, preacher? What is it you think my prince will have?
He is being led to desire a throne, the preacher said. I wish him good luck, but he will need much more than luck.
These are dangerous words, Faradin said. How is it you dare such words?
Ambitions tend to remain undisturbed by realities, the preacher said. I dare such words because you stand at a crossroad. You could become admirable, but now you are surrounded by those who do not seek moral justifications, by advisers who are strategy-oriented. You are young and strong and tough, but you lack a certain advanced training by which your character might evolve. This is sad, because you have weaknesses whose dimensions I have described.
What do you mean? Tychanic demanded. Have a care when you speak, Faradin said. What is this weakness?
You've given no thought to the kind of society you might prefer, the preacher said. You do not consider the hopes of your subjects. Even the form of the Imperium which you seek has little shape in your imaginings.
He turned his masked face toward Tychanic.
Your eye is upon the power, not upon its subtle uses and its perils. Your future is filled, thus, with manifest unknowns, with arguing women, with coughs and windy days. How can you create an epoch when you cannot see every detail? Your tough mind will not serve you. This is where you are weak.
Faradin studied the old man for a long space, wondering at the deeper issues implied by such thoughts, at the persistence of such discredited concepts. Morality, social goals, these were myths to put beside belief in an upward movement of evolution. Titanic said,
"We've had enough words. What of the price agreed upon, preacher?"
"Duncan Idaho is yours," the preacher said. "Have a care how you use him. He is a jewel beyond price."
"Oh, we've a suitable mission for him," Titanic said.
He glanced at Farradin.
"By your leave, my prince."
"Send him packing before I change my mind," Farradin said.
Then, glaring at Titanic,
"I don't like the way you've used me, Tyke."
"Forgive him, prince," the preacher said. "Your faithful Bashar does God's will without even knowing it."
Bowing, the preacher departed, and Titanic hurried to see him away. Farradin watched the retreating backs, thought,
"I must look into this religion which Tyke espouses," and he smiled ruefully. "What a dream interpreter! But what matter? My dream was not an important thing."
And he saw a vision of armor. The armor was not his own skin. It was stronger than plasteel. Nothing penetrated his armor, not knife or poison or sand, not the dust of the desert or its desiccating heat. In his right hand he carried the power to make the Coriolis storm, to shake the earth and erode it into nothing. His eyes were fixed upon the golden path, and in his left hand he carried the scepter of absolute mastery. And beyond the golden path, his eyes looked into eternity, which he knew to be the food of his soul and of his everlasting flesh. Hagia, My Brother's Dream, from The Book of Ganyma.
"It'd be better for me never to become emperor," Leto said. "Oh, I don't imply that I've made my father's mistake and peered into the future with a glass of spice. I say this thing out of selfishness. My sister and I desperately need a time of freedom when we can learn how to live with what we are."
He fell silent, stared questioningly at the Lady Jessica. He'd spoken his piece as he and Ganyma had agreed. Now what would be their grandmother's response? Jessica studied her grandson in the low light of glow globes, which illuminated her quarters in Siege Tabor. It was still early morning of her second day here, and she'd already had disturbing reports that the twins had spent a night of vigil outside the siege. What were they doing? She had not slept well, and she felt fatigue acids demanding that she come down from the hyper-level which had sustained her through all the demanding necessities since that crucial performance at the spaceport. This was the siege of her nightmares, but outside, that was not the desert she remembered.
"Where have all the flowers come from?"
And the air around her felt too damp. Stillsuit discipline was lax among the young.
"What are you, child, that you need time to learn about yourself?" she asked.
He shook his head gently, knowing it to be a bizarre gesture of adulthood on a child's body, reminding himself that he must keep this woman off balance.
"First, I am not a child. Oh,"
he touched his chest, "this is a child's body, no doubt of that, but I am not a child." Jessica chewed her upper lip, disregarding what this betrayed. Her duke, so many years dead on this accursed planet, had laughed at her when she did this.
"Your one unbridled response," he'd called that chewing of the lip. "It tells me that you're disturbed, and I must kiss those lips to still their fluttering."
Now this grandson who bore the name of her duke shocked her into heart-pounding stillness merely by smiling and saying,
"You are disturbed. I see it by the fluttering of those lips."
It required the most profound discipline of her Bene Gesserit training to restore a semblance of calm. She managed,
"Do you taunt me?"
"Taunt you? Never. But I must make it clear to you how much we differ. Let me remind you of that siege orgy so long ago when the old Reverend Mother gave you her lives and her memories. She tuned herself to you and gave you that long chain of sausages, each one a person. You have them yet, so you know something of what Ganyma and I experience."
"And Alia?"
Jessica asked, testing him.
"Didn't you discuss that with Ghani?" "I wish to discuss it with you."
"Very well." Alia denied what she was, and became that which she most feared. The past within cannot be relegated to the unconscious. That is a dangerous course for any human, but for us who are pre-born, it is worse than death. And that is all I will say about Alia."
"So you're not a child," Jessica said.
"I'm millions of years old. That requires adjustments which humans have never before been called upon to make." Jessica nodded, calmer now, much more cautious than she'd been with Ganyma. And where was Ganyma? Why had Leto come here alone?
"Well, Grandmother," he said,
Are we abominations, or are we the hope of the Atreides?"
Jessica ignored the question.
"Where is your sister?"
"She distracts Alia to keep us from being disturbed. It is necessary. But Ghani would say nothing more to you than I've said. Didn't you observe that yesterday?"
"What I observed yesterday is my affair. Why do you prattle about abomination?"
"Prattle? Don't give me your Bene Gesserit cant, grandmother. I'll feed it back to you, word for word, right out of your own memories. I want more than the fluttering of your lips." Jessica shook her head, feeling the coldness of this person who carried her blood. The resources at his disposal daunted her. She tried to match his tone, asked,
"What do you know of my intentions?"
He sniffed.
"You needn't inquire whether I've made the mistake my father made. I've not looked outside our garden of time, at least not by seeking it out. Leave absolute knowledge of the future to those moments of déjà vu which any human may experience. I know the trap of prescience. My father's life tells me what I need to know about it. No, grandmother, to know the future absolutely is to be trapped into that future absolutely. It collapses time. Present becomes future. I require more freedom than that."
Jessica felt her tongue twitch with unspoken words. How could she respond to him with something he didn't already know? This was monstrous.
"He's me. He's my beloved Leto."
This thought shocked her. Momentarily she wondered if the childish mask might not lapse into those dear features and resurrect.
"No."
Leto lowered his head, looked upward to study her. Yes, she could be maneuvered after all. He said,
"When you think of prescience, which I hope is rarely, you're probably no different from any other. Most people imagine how nice it would be to know tomorrow's quotation on the price of whale fur, or whether a Harkonnen will once more govern their home world of Gedi Prime. But of course we know the Harkonnens without prescience, don't we, grandmother?"
She refused to rise to his baiting. Of course he would know about the cursed Harkonnen blood in his ancestry.
"Who was a Harkonnen?" he asked, goading. "Who was Beast Raban? Any one of us, eh? But I digress. I speak the popular myth of prescience, to know the future absolutely, all of it. What fortunes could be made and lost on such absolute knowledge, eh? The rabble believes this. They believe that if a little bit is good, more must be better. How excellent! And if you handed one of them the complete scenario of his life, the unvarying dialogue up to his moment of death, what a hellish gift that'd be. What utter boredom. Every living instant he'd be replaying what he knew absolutely. No deviation. He could anticipate every response, every utterance, over and over and over and over and over and—" Leto shook his head. "Ignorance has its advantages. A universe of surprises is what I pray for."
It was a long speech, and as she listened, Jessica marveled at how his mannerisms, his intonations, echoed his father, her lost son. Even the ideas, these were things Paul might have said.
"You remind me of your father," she said. "Is that hurtful to you?" "In a way, but it's reassuring to know he lives on in you." "How little you understand of how he lives on in me."
Jessica found his tone flat, but dripping bitterness. She lifted her chin to look directly at him.
"Or how your Duke lives in me," Leto said. "Grandmother, Ghanima is you. She's you to such an extent that your life holds not a single secret from her up to the instant you bore our father. And me, what a catalogue of fleshly recordings am I! There are moments when it is too much to bear. You come here to judge us? You come here to judge Alia? Better that we judge you!"
Jessica demanded answer of herself and found none. What was he doing? Why this emphasis on his difference? Did he court rejection? Had he reached Alia's condition? Abomination?
"This disturbs you," he said.
"It disturbs me."
She permitted herself a futile shrug.
"Yes, it disturbs me, and for reasons you know full well. I'm sure you've reviewed my Bene Gesserit training. Ghanima admits it. I know Alia did. You know the consequences of your difference."
He peered upward at her with disturbing intensity.
"Almost we did not take this tack with you," he said, and there was a sense of her own fatigue in his voice. "We know the fluttering of your lips,